Good morning, welcome back to Nachiyomi. Today we are going to be learning a new Sefer. We are starting the book of Iyov, the book of Job. This is a very complicated Sefer, and we're going to spend a little bit of time trying to really unpack it. Many people don't get to the Sefer for a number of reasons. First of all, many of the words which appear in the Sefer appear only in the book of Iyov, making a lot of the concepts hard to understand. In addition, the theology of the Sefer is also very difficult to understand, and oftentimes people have not had a chance to learn it. So congratulations on getting onto the train. This is going to be an incredible journey as we try to learn just a little bit more about this very special Sefer in Ksuvim. Let's take a look at the structure of the Sefer first. This is the third of the Svarim in our canon on Ksuvim. So this is the end of what's called the Sifrei Emes. The first three Svarim of Ksuvim are Tehillim, Mishlei, Iyov, which form the acronym backwards of Emes. They all are unusual in the sense that they have their own system of cantillation and trap. This is the third of those Svarim. The truth is that the story is a interrelationship between prose and songs. A lot of the conversations are in the forms of songs, and a lot of the descriptions are in the form of prose. So there's interwoven themes of philosophy and story which are interwoven into this Sefer. It has a sum total of 1,070 psukim, and is divided into 42 prakim, 42 chapters, which are almost usually accurate to the thematic division of the Sefer, even though they were added later. Generally speaking, there the Sefer is divided into a few major sections. So there's this introduction, then there are monologues. There's Iyov's complaints, then there's the round of arguments between Eliphaz, Iyov, Beldad, Iyov, Tzofer, and Iyov again. Then there's a second round of arguments from the same characters, a third round of arguments from Eliphaz and Iyov, Beldad, and then three straight arguments of Iyov, Elihu's answer in four stages, Hashem's response, and finally the ultimate response of Iyov, followed by the epilogue. So there's a general flow of conversations and dialogues which occur. In terms of the topic of the Sefer, the general topic of the Sefer is theodicy. Theodicy means trying to understand the divine justice of the Almighty, of the Ribbono Shel Olam. The way the Gemara describes it in Bava Basra, Daf Tes Zayin Amud Aleph, is that this Sefer becomes the outcome of a conversation, and here's how the conversation starts. It describes how HaKadosh Baruch Hu one day was having a conversation with the Satan. The Satan is an angel, a minister, a spiritual minister who's in charge of, on one hand, being the castigating agent, the prosecuting agent, also the agent which is the Gemara identifies as the Yetzer Hara itself, is the one that makes stumbling blocks and difficulties for the indulgences of humankind in order to bring out their best. And Hashem is having a conversation with his prosecuting agent. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to the Satan, he says, where you came from? So Satan says, I was shatati b'chol ha'olam. I was around the whole world. I was floating around the whole world. And the Satan says, you know, I've not found a human being who is quite as good as Avraham. Why? You told Avraham Avinu, go and you'll acquire this land. You gave him the promise that this would be the promised land for the promised children. When it came to something as simple as burying his wife, there was no land to be had, but nonetheless, he never had anything to say. Lo hir her achar midoscha. He didn't have any questions. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu responds to the Satan and says, wait a second. Hasamta limcha el avdi Iyov? Did you notice my servant Iyov? You're saying Avraham Avinu is so grand. That's true. But there's also this fellow called Iyov. What about him? He himself is also this incredible Yirei Shamayim, in a person with great integrity. So the Satan says, no, you know what? Satan responds, he's not in the same bracket. You know why? Because the Satan says, you know, he has a lot. He says he's got everything he needs in life. If you were to take away what he needs in life, then you'd see he wasn't really there for you. The only reason he's happy with you is because he's had a good life. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives the Satan the license and says, you know what? He noy biyodcha, he's in your hands. Ach es nafshoy shamar. But don't kill him. The Gemara describes that that's exactly what happened in four stages. The Satan took away everything from Iyov, and ultimately to test Iyov. And therefore, there are four stages in which this story unfolds. First, we see Iyov loses his property, at which point Iyov blesses Hashem, he ratifies the judgment of Hashem. Then you're sick, Iyov is silent, he doesn't bless and he doesn't curse Hashem. He accepts with humility, but not in love. The third stage, he starts to complain, and the fourth stage of suffering, he becomes very bitter, and he becomes upset with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Those are the four stages. enter his friends. Three main friends of Eov. There are more people who are characters over here. But nonetheless, three main friends of Eov, and they argue that Eov was incorrect for getting upset with God. Because ultimately, if he really were to look carefully in himself, he would realize that he deserved the punishment that he was getting. In the way that the friends look at Eov, the way they look at theology in general, is it's very black and white. If you're a tzaddik, you get good. If you're a rasha, you get evil. There's no such concept as a tzaddik, viraloi, a person who is righteous who receives evil. Therefore, if they see a person who is suffering, like Eov, they say, Eov, you must look in your portfolio very carefully, do a careful audit, and you'll find that there's something wrong in the code. There's something wrong you did. You deserve whatever happened to you. Make sure you fix it up. And Eov fights against them, and Eov ultimately disproves them, showing that there was nothing that he did in his life to deserve the suffering that had befallen upon him. Enter Elihu. Elihu seems to be one of the friends, although he wasn't mentioned among the first three at the beginning. And he enters and he seems to be a counterpoint to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that he's saying that HaKadosh Baruch Hu isn't limited to working within the realms of human beings, and Gemul, the way Hashem pays back, is not going to be limited to the realm of payback in this world. It's interesting that although Elihu's words are extremely complex and there's a lot of mefarshim as to what he's really saying, generally speaking, it seems that a lot of the points that he raises are going to be raised by HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the end. But Eov still bats him back, and only when Eov bats back all the friends and there's no one who can really explain and answer and comfort Eov to the degree that he needs to, is when HaKadosh Baruch Hu enters. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu then, in a certain sense, humbles Eov and puts him in his place and shows the complexity of the universe and now how ultimately there is a divine plan. That's the general flow of the Sefer. What is interesting is that we hear many different arguments within the Sefer about divine justice, how HaKadosh Baruch Hu operates. And the Sefer never really gives a conclusive model as to what can always be applied as to understanding the divine justice in Hashem. We hear different ideas. One idea we don't hear so expressly is the idea that it's all about the world to come. This Sefer, like all the rest of the Sfarim in Tanakh, does not emphasize the world to come as being an answer for the suffering within this world. And that's a concept that we need to think about why. Why is the Tanakh does not use the world to come, the idea of a apocalyptic future, there being another world, why does that not that feature as one of the arguments that Tanakh emphasizes on. Very fascinating conversation in and of itself. In terms of the authorship of Eov, there's a number of ideas as to what the name Eov can actually mean. What does the name actually mean? One could be from the name of pain, Eva, so because he lived a life of pain, it could be a name of Eva. Another idea is it could be a permutation of the word Oyev, an enemy, whether that means the Satan became the enemy of Eov, or whether because his friends, the people who were supposed to support him, ultimately sided with the ideal of Tzaddik Vatovlo and not him. Or it could be, as Professor Mazur in a journal called Sion said, the name Eov actually was a pretty common name in some of the journals in those times, in some of the annals of those times. Who actually wrote Eov? When was it set? So the Gemara gives a number of options. In Baba Basra Tadav Tesvavam and Aleph, the Gemara suggests an incredible amount of options. One option is, the predominant option is, that it's Moshe Rabbeinu. Either it was the times of Moshe Rabbeinu or by Moshe Rabbeinu, about a person who lived at the times of Moshe Rabbeinu. In fact, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky has a beautiful essay in his introduction to the Sefer of Eov, which he also mentions at the beginning of Sefer Va'era, in his commentary on the Chumash, in the MS Le'Yaakov, where he points out that there's a Medrash which says that why was it that Bnei Yisrael were not able to listen to Moshe Rabbeinu when he came back? It says, "Olay shamo Moshe mikotzer ruach me'avodah kasha." What was the kotzer ruach? Why were they not able to listen to Moshe after his initial proposal? So the Medrash says, because up till then they had Megillos. They had these parchments which they were reading. And when Paro increased the workload and decreased the supply, they had no time to read these Megillos anymore. And therefore, they were now no longer able to have reason or meaning or mission. And therefore, they were exasperated and they weren't able to listen to Moshe. Well, what were they reading exactly? What were they putting off their bookshelf to read? One of the suggestions Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky has is it was the Sefer of Eov, which is extant at the time, written at the times of Moshe Rabbeinu or by Moshe Rabbeinu earlier in his life. And it gave meaning to a life of suffering. They could, in a certain sense, deal with any how if they had a why. And their why was the book of Eov, which put things into perspective. That's a fascinating example of this idea. But the Gemara gives another few suggestions. It could be in the times of Yitzhak, based on the Pasuk, the times of the Meraglim, the times of Shvot HaShoftim, the times of the book of Shoftim, the times of Achashverosh, the times of Shivas Tzion, the return to Zion. Or the Gemara even suggests a non-Jewish person who experienced this terrible suffering and built up his world to come. There are explicit references of Eov as a real person in the book of Yechezkel. But ultimately, the Gemara, at one of the points, concludes, Lo haya v'lo nivra, he never really was, he was a mashal. Meaning, the idea of Eov is a mashal, the idea of Eov is a parable, it's a parable of this concept of dealing with theology rather than it is a specific person. The Rambam in his Sefer Mor Nevuchim in the third Chelek says that it seems very clear that this cannot have possibly been a human being that really existed. It must be a mashal. However, it seems very clear that over here that there's perhaps when thinking about this, it could mean more than simply just a fairy tale. As Rav Shimon Schwab points out in his introduction to the book of Mishlei, is that Eov is a universal character. He's not a person limited by even being Jewish. He is a person, this is not about specifically religion, it's about a human being's relationship with the divine. And I think the universality of it is precisely what the Gemara is suggesting. Why is it the Gemara says all these different options as to when Eov lived? Because the fact that he was a mashal meant to say that he really lives in every generation. If you look carefully enough, you will find people in every single generation who suffer so immensely and so unrelated to their actions that there is an Eov in every generation. And somehow, it is the generation's responsibility to learn vicariously from those individuals, to learn from their lives the lessons vicariously so they don't need to go through it themselves, to appreciate the divine justice and understanding what creates comfort and what doesn't create comfort. What type of friend of Eov will you be? Because if you look around in every generation, from the times even of Noach, as some of the academics suggest, all the way to the times of Shivat Zion, he exists. Which leads us to the last explanation, and that's the Psikta. The Psikta says that in fact, he was a mashal. You know what he's a mashal for? Not an individual who lived in any generation, but the nation of Israel as they go into Golus. Trying to look at understanding this individual's micro-suffering helps us understand the macro-suffering of the nation of Israel through all the vicissitudes and complexities of history. And yes, therefore, Eov is relevant. Relevant personally, relevant nationally, relevant universally, and relevant always, which is why we started looking forward Perek Aleph tomorrow. In the meantime, have a wonderful and meaningful day.